accession number 20588, reel 3.
Walter Cuss, reel 3. Right, you've arrived in Maidstone. Do you remember what date that was?
Roughly.
Oh, dear.
Month or year?
Maidstone will be 41, sometime in 41.
Right, under the command, went under the command of Montgomery. And so what was it like arriving?
Just recap this a minute.
So you'd come from Hale Y. It's all right, we can check the dates, there's not a problem there. So what was it like when you arrived at Maidstone? I mean, you'd been out in the sticks in Hay-on-Wye.
Well, of course, Maidstone's a big town, isn't it, obviously, and of course there was every facility there. There was cinema, there was pubs, there was all sorts.
And where were you billeted?
Bolt Park.
Mm-hmm. In what sort of accommodation?
In Ernest & Huts again. The Moat Park was owned by Dorothy Padgett, the racehorse owner, you see, at one time, and that was consisted of the messes, men's mess, officers' mess, sergeants' mess, Naffy, the whole lot was in there, and it was quite a big place, and we used to, got on very well there.
Mm. Don't worry about the dates and things, yeah. Tell me what you remember. So how long were you there?
In Maidstone up the we started moving about a bit then in 1940. When was invasion? June. In 43, we were moving to different places.
But when you got to Maidstone?
Maidstone was mainly in Maidstone most of the time.
Right, okay. And what were you doing there?
Oh, exercises. Then there's a lake in Maidstone. We were doing Bailey Bridging on there. That's when we started with the Bailey Bridging, building rafts and so forth, and running vehicles on there and seeing how it would react. The Churchill tanks were involved with it when we were building these bridges. And we also were building what you call makeshift bridges built out of local timber and stuff like that. Mm. So if you was unable to get bridging, you'd use local things, you see, local materials, things like that.
What sort of vehicles were you using?
Well, the vehicles in a field company were Bedford QL lorries, carrier lorries that carry the stores, half tracks. We experimented with a lot of vehicles there. We had Ben Gun carriers. Then we had Humber Scout cars. And eventually, in the final analysis, the vehicles were half tracks, 3-ton Bedford QL lorries, carrier lorries, 1,500 weight trucks, compressors, and things like that. That was the main, each section had the identical vehicles. You see, there were three sections in a field company. Platoons, they were known as then, number one, two, and three. Number one platoon had two half tracks, three Bedford QLs, one compressor truck, one carrier truck, two 1500 weight trucks. That applied to all platoons. Headquarters had an office truck, half track, and also a Morris armored car with central steering. So that was the vehicle complement of a field company.
Were you using any vehicles or equipment that was new, sort of that was being tested or anything like that?
No. No.
So while you were at Maidstone, where else did you go on your exercises?
Well, we had a big exercise, which was a dress rehearsal for the Normandy landings, or Normandy in particular, or landing on France. That exercise was known as Spartan. Now, this was an exercise where you weren't allowed to go in any shops whatsoever, buy any food. You had to live on the land. Live on the rations you were given, like. And this went on for a fortnight and involved the Air Force as well. And this is when they operated this new Typhoon, a new Typhoon rocket fighter that was used. And then we were operating with that, army support, like. And I remember most distinctively that after the end of the exercise, my friend and myself, we went to a bakery and bought two loaves red hot out the oven, and we were that hungry, we ate them as they were. That was one point I particularly remember. Anyhow, this Spartan operation, the enemy were the Canadians, and they operated from Sussex, where they were stationed. We were the enemy, and they were the supporters. Now, we went down to Plymouth, Devon, and every river crossing we came to, we bridged it, and we ended up in Luton. All these bridges were built under any condition, weather condition, no matter what the weather was, they had to be built. And I remember we were building a Bailey Bridge over the Basingstoke Canal under a heavy thunderstorm, and we're still building this bridge. And that was it, like, you know.
How long did it take you to get from Plymouth to...
Well, it was a fortnight. The exercise consisted of a fortnight, you see. And that was the final exercise before the real thing.
Did they think the exercise had gone well?
Or? Oh, yes. Oh, it was all planned out in detail. Little to my knowledge, you know what I mean.
Mm. Mm. So, was there just a bit of excitement mounting now that you were actually...
Well, everybody realised then, because of a simple reason, at that particular time, people were learning, they were building concrete landing craft or replicas of landing craft. You were driving vehicles into this water, and they had to be waterproof, obviously, if we're in water, and driving out again. So we knew then, whatever we were going to do, we were going to land somewhere on some beach. It's obvious that was. Of course, nobody knew anything about it. It was top secret.
So where did you think the beaches could be?
Well, obviously, it was going to be France. I mean, no other place they could possibly go. I mean, you already made landings in Italy mm-hmm. and places like that.
So what were your thoughts at the prospect of landing in enemy-occupied France?
Well, when you're young, you don't think of things like that. I mean, when you get older, you start to think of things, why, what's going to happen to me and all this. You didn't think of things like that. You wanted to get on with the job. I particularly did in my own personal way. Let's get on with it and get it over with. Because don't forget, the war had been on nearly five and a half years then.
Mm. And you hadn't seen any action. Did that disappoint you?
Some ways.
Did you feel you were being saved for something special?
I think so, yeah. Mm.
You felt that at the time, did you?
I would say this. When I was at the time of Maidstone, 53rd was one of the finest trains divisions in the country, on a par with, I would say this, on a par with the Marines and the Paras. They were 100% trained. Now, in Maidstone, there was a complete reorganization. Most of the TA people got posted, and the company was whittled practically down to skeleton proportions. We took a vast intake of Royal West Kent infantrymen, and they were retrained as engineers. They learned explosives, demolitions, minefields, all the rest of it. All theory, obviously, at that particular time. That eventually, this was common right through the division. Men got posted. Infantry was in short supply, especially out in the Middle East and Italy like that. They had taken a lot of casualties. And, of course, these men got posted, and we had to retrain. And most of the men who came into my company didn't go in the army till 42. They were youngsters, 19, because conscription age dropped to 18 at that time and became a problem. So they were made up of people like that, you see.
So you were one of the old hands by then?
Oh, yeah, one of the old hands, all right. Oh, yeah.
What did you think of the youngsters coming in? Because they hadn't had anything, I mean, no training.
Well, a couple of good friends of mine got posted. I mean, I'll give you an example. We were going out one Sunday night for a drink, and a sergeant major company said to the friend of mine, he said, I'm afraid you won't be able to go out now, Len. He said, well, of course, Len said, what's the point? He said, you've been posted. And he was posted to the Middle East. And he left. And I always noticed all his kit and everything, he got killed up there. The minefield.
Yeah. Did you want to be posted somewhere?
No, I was quite happy where I was.
Did it feel safe when you were doing all this training in the UK?
Pardon?
Did you feel safe when you were doing all the training in the UK, or was it just...
Yes, it was okay. I mean, when you're a young person, you don't think of things like that. I mean, same as a fighter pilot, a lot of them were 18, 20 pilots, sergeant pilots, right? If I've spoken to many of them, different methods. He said, knowing what I know now, I would have never done this and done that, as you see. It's the same as somebody went in a VC. You don't know what's going on. You don't realise it. When you're in the thick of things, you do things automatic. It's a law of survival.
True. So, eventually, you would somehow learn that you were going off to France. How did you learn about
it? Anyhow, we moved from Maidstone. My company moved from Maidstone to Herne Bay and a place called Chesterfield and Faversham, all split up around there, all up the way. Now, I think it was done. I think that was done because when we moved out of Maidstone, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers moved into Maidstone. Now, most of them, Royal Welsh Fusiliers or infantry, were way out over the sticks somewhere, you know. And I think they moved them in there for them to have a bit of life before they went overseas. That's what I think. Because we've been in Maidstone quite some time. We were in Herne Bay, Chesterfield and Faversham. Now, Chesterfield, we moved from there to the embarkation areas.
And where were they?
That was London Docks and New Haven.
So how did you hear that you were going for embarkation?
Well, first of all, we were kitted out. Waterproofing vehicles were the first thing. Waterproofing vehicles. And that necessitated stripping the carburetors down, all that, breathing apertures in the differential and gearboxes and so forth. And we're doing this waterproofing. Everybody was moving about. New kit was being issued out. They replaced the side cap with a Betty and all of this. You look like farmers' boys or them things, anyhow, I thought. Then we moved from there to London Docks. My regiment, anyhow. I mean, they all move different places. Obviously, you can't ship a division out all in one piece. You've got to be shipped from different places. Anyway, we went to London. We went to East Ham Stadium. Now, what I got to say there now in East Ham, on the way into East Ham, the EastEnders were marvellous. They were really marvellous. There's an old year on the side of the road, she gave me a bar of Cadbury's chocolate, half a piece of Lifebuoy soap and 5 Woodbines. I'll never forget that, in a brown paper bag. And kissed me on the cheek. When we got into East Ham, it was a vast camp, and it was sealed off. And you had cinemas, outdoor cinemas, and all of this. So plenty of time, plenty of things, good naffies in there. But then one particular night, we were allowed out, providing we didn't discuss anything. Now, we went to a pub in Canning Town. I don't know the name of it, but nobody bought anything. It was all paid for. Now the EastEnders, you probably know, they like their jellied eels and things like that. And they put a plate of jelly eels in front of me. I couldn't eat that, no way. But anyhow, they bought us drinks. We never paid for anything.
Was there word about, you know, invasion going to happen?
Well, obviously something's going on, because there's all these troops moving in there, and all the transport being shipped down the road and loaded on ships and all that. I mean, it's bound to be known something's going on. But it didn't get out, I suppose. Nobody seemed to know about it, or the Germans didn't know about it.
Mm. So you had quite a night in Canning Town?
We had a nice time. Well, we were there about 2 days, I think it was. Then we got on this ship. Now, we loaded on this ship, the Liberty ship, the American Liberty ship. Mm. Now, the Americans were dead keen on jackknives, and they'd offer anything for a jackknife, so they weren't supposed to sell a jackknife. Of course, these chaps are selling the jackknives, but these Americans. Anyhow, we loaded this ship up now, and we got out off Sheerness. Now, we anchored now, because apparently there was a storm in the channel, and we were held up. Now, what I'm saying is this, we were what you call a follow-up force, L force. We were a follow-up force sailing from London Dock. The D-Day landings had already taken place now, and we got in there into France, I think, about June the 22nd, something like that. And we went into action straight away, more or less. Landed all the beaches, off landing craft. We were offloaded off the Liberty ship into landing craft, landed on the beaches, and we ended up in a place called Soublay.
Right. Let's just do a little bit more on the journey across. Do you know the name or number of the Liberty ship or you were on?
I got the name of the ship here somewhere, but I can't...
can't remember, never mind.
I can't remember it.
Do you know how many people were on the ship?
There was the Royal Artillery Group on there and Royal Engineers on the ship. And the OC troops on the ship was a Royal Artillery officer, because the Royal Artillery was senior to the engineers, you see.
Right. And how long were you on the ship?
About four. You see, we anchored off Sheerness for a couple of days, and then we moved out in convoy, and we were sleeping in the holds in hammocks. Mm-hmm. Some blokes wouldn't go in a hammock; they slept on the floor. And one particular chap, he got really frightened. He wouldn't go and sleep in the hammock down the hole. He was thinking he was going to get torpedoed, and let his thoughts run away with him. We had to control him a bit, keep him quiet.
How'd you do that?
Well, try to pacify him, you know. Oh, it's going to be all right and all this and all. Anyhow, he went through the Straits of Dover, nothing happened. Land, got off the beaches. And during the time we were on there, we used to have boxing competitions and things like that, you know, occupy the time.
What was the atmosphere like then?
Well, it was atmosphere, for want of a better word, it was more or less like a holiday atmosphere, I thought. I mean, didn't give it a thought as to what we were going to do. We knew we were going there, obviously, now we've been briefed on it, you see.
Do you remember that briefing?
What I got to recap, I got to say this, I've missed this. Mm-hmm. When we were in Chesterfield, the flying bombs started dropping, right? And they dropped, they wondered what these things were, they were going over at night, and it was going on London. Of course, whilst we were in London, in East Ham, these flying bombs were landing every couple of minutes.
Really?
In London. Really devastating the place. So that puts that right. So now we're back on the beaches in Normandy now.
Well, we're still on the ship, so...
We're on the ship.
Yeah.
We're getting to Normandy. We left, off-landed on the landing craft.
Right. So what was the food? Just to get a little bit more information.
Well, what you had to go to Normandy, we had two 24-hour packs.
Right. So and you didn't there, eat those on the ship?
No, no.
They fed you on
for
the
landing.
Ship, did they?
After landing. They fed you on the ship. You were fed on the ship. With compa rations, right, which is a 14-man... Continued rations for 14 men in a comp, mm-hmm, about that length, about that wide. How lived on comp rations.
So you were on the ship, and then how did you know, you know, did they tell you when you were going to go forward onto the...
Well, the ship landed off in Normandy, and nothing happened for a minute until you had a tannoy system, you see, which you bring forward so and so and so and so and so and so. Anyway, we landed on the landing craft. You had to get down the side of the ship in scaling nets. Are on the landing craft. Now, this is an American landing craft. And these were Americans landed us. Oh, everything was American. The ship we went over on was an American, and the landing craft was an American. And we went ashore on the landing craft, landed on the beach, up on the beach. Exits, and on the beach consisted of various exits on the beach. And each exit was commanded by a beach officer, what he called a beach officer. He was responsible for seeing you got on there and off and so forth.
What was the beach? Can you describe it?
Sand
what
beach.
What does it look like?
It was Aramanch is the name of the beach.
Yes.
And right opposite, this thing's been on the television time and time again. This building right in front of you, like a hotel. Mm-hmm. That's where we landed. And we got off the beach, went along the road, and the first thing we done, pulled into an area, de-waterproof the vehicles, obviously, because you can't drive a vehicle. I mean, we'd driven these vehicles all the way from Chesterfield to London, waterproofed. And, of course, the first thing you've got to do is take off the waterproofing, which we did, all the vehicles. Now then, Lieutenant Quamby, one of our officers, thought Germans were around the corner, and he was running around with a revolver in the air and all this sort of business. And such with our officers that you could talk to them, and they could talk to you, and you know what I mean. It was, we were trained that much, we knew exactly what to do. So we had to stand to now, first light and last light, because that was the most obvious time. If we're going to get attacked, it was either first light, mm-hmm, preferably first light, and it was 4 o'clock in the morning. Of course, obviously, it was in June. And... we moved up this position then, and of course we went into an area then. And of course our infantry then were relieving the 15th Scottish Division. They went straight into action, infantry off the ship, straight into action. And we supported them, went up with them. Any engineering work necessary to be done, such as lifting mines or craters or something like that, that the work had to be done. And I remember the first time I was in this, all had to dig in. Everybody had to be dug in a foxhole.
So this, can we just go back? You stopped on the road to de-waterproof the vehicles, and the officer called Quarmby was running about with his
Lieutenant Quarmby.
Where did you go from there?
Well, we moved to another area then, which was,
you know, where that was?
What do you call a brigade area? No names, all right. Place was covered in dust, everything. You didn't know where the hell you were, to be honest about it.
Okay.
Anyway, we moved into this area and we were there about a fortnight. Mm-hmm. And during that time, the Germans used to fly over. Photographing areas. If he come over your area, you could be shelled within a matter of half an hour or mortared. Now, I remember a time now, there was a chap called Lofty, I can't remember his other name. You had to do a stint on a double Bren gun, you see, which was passive air defence, it was known as. And you were responsible for firing his aircraft if they flew low enough. Anyhow, this Messerschmitt came over one afternoon and we were flying quite low. Of course, he got that really, shall we say, tied up with firing this aircraft. He didn't realise it. As he was firing it, he was bringing the gun down, you see, and he was firing tracers. And of course, set the officer's tent on fire, didn't they? Because the tracers went through the tent, set the thing on fire. So they were absolute men, because that place is firing, and Germans was known to fire. They'd seen a tent on fire, and obviously there was something there. And then we got shelled pretty badly after that, but no damage was done.
Nobody killed.
But you see, in Normandy, with so many things concentrated together, it doesn't matter what he fired at, he hit something. It was open country, he hit something.
What was the atmosphere like among you all there? I mean, suddenly, you've been, after years of training, you were suddenly in action.
Well, it's difficult to describe, really. It's difficult to describe. I mean, it's a law of survival, obviously. You're going to get jumped down in a hole somewhere if you're going to get shelled and mortared. All the infantry were dug in, unless they were on the march, you see. And that's where their part is. They put in attack. Of course, they weren't protected. They had nothing to live in, dive into. Well, it was a lot of little incidents. Too numerous to mention, really.
Give me one.
Well, we're on a crossroads. And we had a chap there with a klaxon horn. Now, every time the aircraft come over, he sounded his klaxon horn because we were using this compressor, you see. We were blowing up roadblocks and things like that. If when you've got an army going through a certain area, it's known as an axis. Everything goes along this axis. It might be a main road, we might have to build roads across country, you see. Things like that. And we were on this klaxon now, I'll never forget this. This is rather macabre, really. He came over now, about 12 Messerschmitts, started machine gunning. So everybody was going to dive everywhere. So everybody was running around now, and I dug down a hole. Two of us jumped in this hole, and it was a routine pit, you see. It's the law of survival, you've got to get somewhere. Of course, everybody had to hoose us down then. Went in this house with it's a big chateau, it was. Went in this house, got some water and washed ourselves down with that. And there was a chap from Ireland, a friend of mine, Jack Fullerton his name was. Now, he was a comic. He was the life and soul of our section. He went in this house now, and I'd seen this chap come out. Now, I rolled with an umbrella over his head, a straw hat on, a frock-tailed coat and a pair of pinstriped trousers. And I thought it was the chap who'd owned the place, you see. Was this? He dressed up in these clothes and things like that. Of course, there was another thing that, little incidents like that.
So, did your company experience casualties in the early days?
Pardon?
Did your company experience casualties in the early days?
We had a casualty there, Sergeant Norgrove, it was. He went out on a patrol and he got badly wounded and we couldn't get him out, so we pushed him out. I didn't do it, this is some of the men. Pushed him under a hedge and we were going to pick him up at night. Anyhow, they went up at night and he was dead. So that was okay. We didn't have a lot of casualties.
Mm. What was the effect of the first casualty on your mood?
Well, at that time, you'd seen so many people dead now. There were so many people dead that you sort of got immune to it. It's obvious, that is. You had to. You couldn't dwell on it. I mean, there was a big tank battle at a place called Schur. German and British tanks. And I'm going to say it was macabre, because there were bodies hanging out of the turrets, burnt, the people burnt, and things like that. And turrets, you looked in a turret, there's a shell that hit the tank. I mean, you don't mind me telling you this, do you?
No.
It was mincemeat. It was real mincemeat. And I understand that when they took these tanks back for repair, the REME, Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, used to hose them out with creosote, because that was the only way to get them out, rather than, you know, bag it up or something like that. Running over men, that sort of thing, tanks going over men, that sort of thing. I got to say this, I personally think that the Battle of Normandy as such was more attrition than anything.
Really?
Because it was a real slogging match. A lot of men got lost, and our own division lost a hell of a lot of men in Normandy. Hell of a lot of men.
Do you think that's the way the offensive was designed, as it were?
The what?
Do you think that was inevitable, the way that the invasion was undertaken?
Well, obviously, when the invasion was planned, I was obviously going to take casualties. I mean, you don't go ashore without something happening. But what was she saying at one point in time? Anyhow, we got up. Now we built a water point. One of the first jobs we'd done was build a water point for the brigade. That's supplying, that's pumping water out of rivers, purifying it, and putting it in a massive canvas container. And all these infantry people used to come with their water trucks and fill their water trucks up with the water. And this was on either the River Orne or the River Orne, I can't be sure which. Up on the top of the hill was a place called Baron. Now, we had to go up there to do a job up there, and that was blowing up a roadblock. Now, all the infantry were dug in, trenches and all the rest of it, and the Germans you could see running around in the wood in front of us. Anyhow, we blew this thing up. So the following night, A Company of the Welsh Regiment went up to do an attack, and all the Germans were dug in. You see, the roads in Normandy are sunken roads, and you've got banks up like that, so you could be easily ambushed. We went up this road now, and all of A Company probably got wiped out. So they brought the flamethrowers up and burnt the Germans out underneath where they were dug in, under these banks. Burnt the Germans out. And it was one thing that you faced with, then you see all our blokes dead, lying on the ground, their faces covered with blue bottles and all the rest of it. But you got to a point, it didn't affect me anyhow. Matter of fact, it didn't affect me. But because it's casualties, you get that in war, and that's it. Yeah. That was one instance.
Does all this affect some people quite?
Oh, it affected one particular charge sergeant, whose name I'm not going to tell you. He jumped in the river when he got mortared, and they had to send him back. Battle casualty. Mm. Send him back.
What was the feeling among you about that?
What was the law of survival? You know, I'm going to say, you've got to protect as best you can. I mean, you can't be a coward and say, I'm not going to do this. You've got to do it, and that's it.
Did you look down on this chap who jumped in the river? I
mean, not really, no. Not really. Mm. Well, I personally didn't myself. Mm. I mean, everybody's not made the same. You see, I've got strong views about that. Some men can take it, some can't.
Right. So that's end of reel 3 for Walter Cass.